EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody at above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merge 295. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Do we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
And a dispatch. Bob, I swear to God, 4 calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
4 calls.
4 calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. Hello everyone and welcome to the show, wherever in the world you are listening from. How are you all doing? We are in Oklahoma tonight to hear from Beth, and she has had multiple paranormal experiences of shadow figures, entities of the negative kind, poltergeists, along with a possible mantis connection and a UFO sighting. Beth up next. If you enjoy listening to the podcast and would like to help support my work, there is a couple of ways to do this. Either you can join Patreon and become a patron of the show for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate via PayPal, and if you like, you can set up monthly reoccurring payments. All links to support the podcast are below in the show notes and on the website. Any help is extremely appreciated, and it helps the show to continue running. Now, on with the show. Good morning, Beth, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Nick.
Thank you for taking the time out this morning to share with us, calling from Oklahoma.
Yes, very hot here.
Oklahoma, lovely. Beth, you have several experiences you're going to be sharing with us. Would you like to start at the very beginning, please, ma'am?
Yes, I would. I was about 3 or 4 years old, so around 1969 or 1970, our family was spending Christmas Eve with our grandparents in Sulphur, Oklahoma, a small town in Oklahoma. And we were there along with our aunts and uncles. When I say we, it was me and my sister and my parents. So we were there with our aunts and uncles and our cousins. So all of us and my aunt spent the night, Christmas Eve, in the attic. So the house had one large spacious room with several large windows and a high ceiling for the attic. We all had sleeping bags and we were really excited. We were exhausted from the excitement and we had no trouble getting to sleep that night. In the middle of the night, I don't know exactly what time it was, but it was quite dark and I woke up. I don't recall why I woke up. It was dark with only the moonlight coming through the windows, the soft illumination. No one else was awake, and I walked over to one of the large windows and looked outside. I immediately saw 3 red, reddish glowing lights in the sky, halfway between the dark rooftops I could see across the street and the zenith of the sky within my visual range. The lights appeared slightly larger in diameter than a star, and they were in a loose line, moving in a slow, smoothly bobbing progression laterally from left to right across the sky. I was awestruck. I felt so much elation and excitement because I just knew this was Santa Claus and reindeer. And so I stood and watched this settlement as this trail of red lights slowly disappeared from my view off to the right. And then I excitedly went to my cousin's sleeping floor in their sleeping bag, trying to wake up, gently shake. I wanted to let them know I saw Santa Claus and the reindeer. I tried to wake up my aunt, but she wouldn't wake up either. So eventually I went back to the window. I didn't see the lights reappear. And I knew I should probably get back in my sleeping bag or Santa Claus wouldn't come down the chimney with his presents. So I was actually recently talking to my mom about this memory and asked her if I had said anything to her or dad or anyone the next morning, Christmas morning. And she said yes. She clearly remembers me telling everyone several times that I had seen Santa Claus's lights in the sky. And my mom said that Bertha, my grandmother, had arranged for a man dressed up as Santa Claus to actually visit the house that Christmas morning, and that I was not interested in him one bit. I personally don't remember that, the dressed up Santa Claus thing to the house, but mom said that she remembers it very well, and I clearly was not interested in him. Again, in 1969 or 1970, we were in Wichita, Kansas, where I lived at the time. And after that Christmas Eve sighting of the red light, sometime during that following year, I had a frightening, vivid, recurring dream. I feel that I must have been about 4 years old. Our bedrooms were upstairs. At the top of the stairs, which ran along one of the inside walls of the house, a long hall ran across to the opposite wall, the end of which was my bedroom. My parents' bedroom was on the left side of the hall next to my bedroom. And then my sister's bedroom, who was a baby at the time, was next to our parents. She was one or two. And there was a bathroom halfway along the hall between the top of the stairs and our bedroom. In this dream, I was asleep in my bed. So I was actually asleep, but in my dream, I was also asleep. And I always had to have my door open. I, young as I can remember, I was afraid of sleeping and I had to have the door open. So in this dream, I was asleep in my bed and I was awakened by a feeling of dread, like a foreboding fear and dread, because I somehow knew that something was coming up the stairs to get me. I woke up and propped myself on my side, on one elbow, where I could see through my open door to the end of the hall at the top of the stairs. I could hear something coming up the stairs, and to my horror, a large tiger topped the stairs, turned into the hall, and stared at me. It then began walking toward me, staring at me the entire time. And it's so vivid, I can see it clearly to this day. I remained frozen for a few interminable minutes, but was always able to manage to scream and wake up. And of course, Dad or Mom would come to my room and stay there so I could go back to sleep. I had this dream at least 5 or 6 times, always the same. In 1970, about in Wichita, Kansas, I had what I would now designate as a lucid dream. This one wasn't a recurring dream. It was one dream. Again, I was about 4 years in the middle of the night, but it must have been nearing dawn because I had this slightest tinge of like a silvery gray to the darkness. I got out of bed and walked out of my bedroom and into my parents' bedroom. And my mom always slept on the side of their bed, which was nearest their door. I don't recall feeling afraid, but I do recall feeling strange, as though I was dreaming, but somehow not dreaming. I walked to my mom's side of the bed, and as I was approaching, I saw many miniature off-white colored paper parachutes with strings on them, from which dangled those plastic green military toy men, and they were appearing from the ceiling of their bedroom above my mom, floating slowly downward onto my mom's side of the bed. I watched in amazement as they continued to appear at the top of the ceiling, float slowly downward, and land on my mom's pillow and on top of her side of the bedspread. I even reached out and touched one of the toy men with its parachute, picked it up, turning around in my hand. It was real. I do not remember what happened after that, not at all. My memory abruptly ends at that point. I have no idea where I could have seen toy men parachutes, as my sister and I had no toys like that, and I didn't go to any type of daycare where I would have seen them. So moving ahead a bit to Oklahoma, we moved to Oklahoma when I was 5 and my sister was about 2 and a half, so around 1972. We had moved into a one-story house where the bedroom, which I shared with my sister, was at one end of a hall, and our parents' bedroom was at the opposite end of a hall. And there was a room close to my parents' bedroom, which was used as a study. I was actually around 6 years old, and my sister and I were playing with our large, colorful bird puppets, which we loved, making them run through the living room and into our room in a loop. We had stopped with the bird puppets in our bedroom, and I clearly remember standing in the bedroom and talking to my sister about our puppets and what we were to play, what we were going to do and play next with them. When I saw a figure in my peripheral vision, I stood very still, and without turning my head, I focused my attention on this figure. It was a male figure who was wearing what I somehow understood to be an old-fashioned suit, and the suit jacket was multicolored and was glowing slightly, and he was leaning against the doorway of our bedroom and watching us play. I sensed that he was smiling and that he seemed to be safe or benign. I then turned my head to look straight at him, and his face was directed at me. I couldn't distinctly see his facial features or the color of his eyes, but I knew he was looking at me. He wore a medium brown colored fedora hat, and when I turned to look at him directly, he brought up his hand, bent his head down slightly, and took his hat at me. Then he slowly faded away and disappeared. Again, in this house, in 1973 or 1974, I would often play happily by myself in the woods behind our house, which had a small, shallow creek running through it. I revered the trees and was in my true element, observing the insects and birds and small animals, exploring the woods, the creek bed, the plants and stones and vines. I was playing one day near the creek bed and was sitting and moving the soft, silty dirt around with a stick. And a thought precisely arose in my head, seemingly out of nowhere. It just entered my mind. I did not formulate this thought. And it was a single sentence. And it said, "You were a witch." Now, I was only 7 or 8 years old. I didn't know what to make of this and had no idea what to do with such a thought. But I know now in retrospect that it arose in part in response to my love of the woods and nature, my feeling of being home when in those woods, and that it most likely was a past life remembrance. But at that time, when I heard those words drop like pebbles into my mind, I was not afraid. I could only wonder at it. I knew about the general idea of a witch only as it related to Halloween, but this feeling and context was completely different, and I had knowledge of the true history, practice of Wicca, and treatment abuse of witches. Of note, aside from my fear of going to sleep and a sense of persistent unease regarding bedtime, my childhood up until the age of 10 was generally happy. I loved to read. I could read for hours, and I immersed myself in all things artistic available to children. I was building cairns outside before I knew what they were, spending hours with my light bright, drawing with colored pencils. I woke up each day anticipating my time exploring the backyard wilderness, and I was endlessly curious and somewhat headstrong. To all outward appearances, my sister and I were raised in a stable home with a relatively healthy family dynamic. My parents attended the Church of Christ until around 1980. I myself held a strong inherent distaste for the church and Orthodox religion, which began as early as I can remember, but I didn't voice this until my later teen years. My father was a well-respected doctor who expanded the oeuvre of his medical practice to include hypnosis and holistic medicine in the mid-1970s, beginning then. My mom had been a fourth grade teacher who became a stay-at-home mom after I and my sister were born, and we were financially comfortable. Again, in this same house, around 1975, I must have been eight years old or so when the following experience occurred. Our mom had rearranged our bedroom so that my bed and my sister's bed were now on opposite sides with our desks between them, and our desks had like a tall bookshelf on top of each one of them. So this created a type of screen between us. My bed was directly against the wall as as you walked through the door into the bedroom. My sister's bed was again opposite wall, furthest from the door. I thought I awoke. It might have been a lucid dream, but I thought I woke up. It was in the middle of the night, and there was a dark, blacker than black shadow figure. I knew it was male. It had a male energy, and it was hovering directly over me, close to my face, almost on top of me, and I was overcome with fear and horror. It felt as though this figure were lying on me, directly on top of me, and I felt that I had difficulty breathing, like it was smothering me, and I couldn't move. I closed my eyes, and I made the effort to scream as loudly as I could, and I called out for my parents. When I opened my eyes, the figure was gone. My heart was racing. I was breathing shallowly and quickly, and I was still afraid to move. It makes me a little afraid right now talking about it. But I think I was able to get out of bed and run down the hall to our parents' bedroom, but I don't remember what happened after that. Again, in the same house, it was about 1976 when I was in fifth grade. My fifth grade teacher, I was in my classroom. My fifth grade teacher had become frustrated and angry by another student's behavior. She was standing behind her desk. The chalkboard was behind her, and I was watching her. Suddenly, I witnessed a flowing wave of brownish red spurt from the top of her head, slowly spread down the side of her head. It looked like she was wearing liquid brownish red halo. It then, I saw it for about, a good 3 or 4 minutes while she was standing up there talking, and you could clearly see she was frustrated, but I saw this red halo around her head for a good 3 or 4 minutes. Later, I told my parents about it, and my dad said that I had seen her aura. So that was the first time I heard about auras. Again, in 1976, I was in fifth grade. I was 10 years old. I began to experience a loathing and hatred toward my body, and I would stand in front of a mirror in our bathroom. It was a bathroom off of my sister, the bedroom I shared with my sister. I would stand in this bathroom, which had a large mirror, and with my hands and fists, I would beat and pound my arms, my stomach, my thighs repeatedly and on many occasions, leaving bruises. Concomitantly, I began to experience what I now know to be depression. I felt alone. I began to feel confused, overwhelmed, and detached from, and I felt unlike and detached from any of my schoolmates. I had a few friends, but feelings of detachment began to grow at that time. We moved to another house in the same town in Oklahoma. It was between fifth and sixth grades. I was around 10 to 11 years old. And my sister was around 7 years old. We moved to a large house, which had a few acres of land. There was an upstairs floor in this house, which consisted of 3 bedrooms and a bathroom. And my sister and I, for a year or two, shared one of those bedrooms, after which each of us occupied a separate bedroom. I will never forget the first time our parents took my sister and I to the house on Hidden Valley to see it before we moved in. The living room was very large with a floor of Spanish tile, which continued around a corner into the dining room. The glass doors at the rear of the living room opened onto a large back porch, next to which was a swimming pool. Beyond the porch and the swimming pool, to the general east, stretched a length of green grass and an old giant oak tree, beside which our parents made a fire pit and cooked hot dogs and s'mores in the summers. Also behind the house near the north edge of the property was a small single-bedroom guest house where our maternal grandfather and grandmother stayed occasionally when not traveling, and where our grandfather lived after our grandmother passed away. On the general south edge of the property, behind and to the south of the main house, was a small barn where for a few years my sister and I had 2 horses. To the east of the grassy property, to the east of the little house, as we named it, and the barn, was a stretch of extremely dense, dark woods and tangled vines, which led to the eastern limit of the property, and through which it was possible to navigate even on horseback, and our horses did not enjoy in the least my and my sister's few attempts to force them to enter it. So returning to the interior of the house, to the right of the living room, ran a short hall to our parents' bedroom. They had a little sitting room and a large bathroom. And also to the right of the living room, opposite the hall that led to our parents' bedroom, was a flight of stairs leading to the upstairs bedrooms and bathroom, which I mentioned earlier. On the day that we walked through the house for the first time, as my sister and I began walking up the stairs, our parents in front of us, I immediately began to feel an oppressive weight, which I had already in a few places throughout the main floor of the house. I'd already felt this, although less intensely. However, as we walked up the stairs and passed a strange stained glass window, which to me radiated an ominous energy and gave me the creeps, and this window was situated midway up the stairs, this feeling of oppressive weight increased. The bedroom at the end of the hall on the right had been the previous family's teenage boys' room. I learned this a little later. And every wall was painted black, and it exuded a malignant feeling. My sister and I talked later about this, and both of us felt it. I remember looking at the other rooms, but all I remember about that initial upstairs walkthrough was that terrible room with the black walls and the oppressive feeling the entire upstairs. So we lived there at that house. We call it the Hidden Valley House in Oklahoma from 1977 to 1984. As I entered sixth grade in the fall of 77, I began to severely restrict the amount of food I ate. I turned 11 years old in September of that year. My feelings of isolation, sadness, anger, confusion, and of being overwhelmed had increased, and I began to obsess on becoming weightless, even to this day. I felt only disgust and anxiety about my body, and I didn't understand any of this. All I knew was that it was imperative that I not eat. In my later adolescence, while undergoing several years of psychotherapy, I came to understand the complex psychological underpinnings and family dynamics which led to the development of anorexia nervosa. But at the time of its greatest, most unrelenting grip on me, I understood nothing about it. Again, I was 11 years old, and I was completely helpless to combat it. Although my father was a doctor, my parents did not know about anorexia nervosa, and in fact, it was not commonly known in the general medical community at all in 1978, much less in the realm of the media and fashion. Twiggy was a public model and a public figure at the time who was extremely thin. But the diagnosis of anorexia nervosa was not then well known, and it wasn't known even later, to my knowledge, that she actually had been anorexic. And I didn't know who Twiggy was until my later teen years. Likewise, it wasn't known that Karen Carpenter, I don't know if you know who Karen Carpenter was, you probably do. She was a famous musician and singer. She had been diagnosed with anorexia nervosa, and I didn't know about this until my later teen years early 20s. Her long struggle with anorexia was unpublicized. She died from heart failure in 1980, the direct complication of anorexia. She was young. A full account of diagnostic criteria for anorexia was published in the DSM-3 when it was released in 1980. My struggle with the most deadly phase of anorexia for me began at age 11 in 1978 and began to slowly ease into severity at the age of 13. However, the disease and its sequela would maintain its grip within me, although loosening gradually and stubbornly, and only with the help of my family's efforts, the efforts of three women, one a Reiki master, one a powerful psychic from England, and one a well-known psychic in the U.S. at that time, and the years I spent in therapy. Suffice it to say, there was a dual dynamic in process during this time, which extended from my childhood to the onset of my illness and through my early 20s. But the reverberations of this dynamic for me and for my sister have permeated our lives to the present day. For the purpose of this journaling and this talk, I'm focusing on the dynamic of the paranormal and anomalous. These events were tangled and braided in the dynamic of traumatic family events from the beginning, along with the anomalous events since our childhood and continued through our early teen years. When we moved into that Hidden Valley house, my sister and I shared the bedroom at the end of the hall, upstairs on the right, that bedroom which had been painted black. Our parents had repainted it and decorated it. Beds were across from each other. My sister's bed was nearest the door, and my bed was in the corner. In our previous home, we had a ritual of lining our stuffed animals around our beds as protection, and we continued this at this house at Hidden Valley. First night that we slept in the room at Hidden Valley, my sister and I had our animals lining our beds, and we distinctly heard a ticking noise exactly symmetrical, a symmetrical beat, beginning at the point where the bedroom wall met the ceiling, beginning at the corner of the door, and continuing in a metronomic rhythm, moving above my sister's head, along the wall to above my bed, across to the opposite corner, and then moving back toward my bed, to my sister's bed, back to the door, and then it would repeat this process until we finally went to sleep. I don't know if it continued after we went to sleep, but it started around bedtime when it got dark and would not stop. This continued every night for several years. My sister and I were terrified. We told our parents, and our dad checked the windows and the roof outside, but found nothing. And it continued. If I or my sister had to get up at night to go to the bathroom, we ran. My sister and I felt both the dread and fear associated with an overwhelming sense of atmospheric density and oppression in that house, especially upstairs, to the point that we constantly felt something right behind us, looking over our shoulders, stalking us, watching us. And on certain areas of the grounds, particularly the dense wooded area in back, we felt this as well. Aside from the huge oak tree, which I loved, in the grassy area of the backyard, I felt no sense of happiness or connection as I had previously in the woods at the previous house when exploring outside. When I played the piano inside in the living room, the piano was located in the living room, in the corner of the living room, close to the glass door let out to the porch. When I played the piano, I would see two or three shadow figures in my peripheral vision, and they were standing or moving slowly in the living room on the Spanish tile area in front of the stairs, which led up to our bedrooms. My sister and I would pass through freezing areas of the house, often in the hallways, both downstairs and upstairs. I would see shadow figures in other areas of the house, but most of the time while I was playing the piano, and they really frightened me. I was in my parents' bathroom one afternoon. I was alone for the moment, and I was washing my hands at the sink. As I was drying my hands, the soap dish flew from the sink countertop over the bathtub across the room and landed on the carpet. I stood frozen, staring at it, and then I ran out of the room. I cannot overemphasize the extent to which my sister and I particularly felt this malevolent, unrelenting sense of oppression and ill intent. Several times we go spend a week at a Holiday Inn to relax and get away from the house, or when we went to visit relatives for a weekend or went out of town for some time. I did well in school academically, but I remained anxious and shy in that environment. My weight plummeted to 52 pounds in seventh grade when I was 11, 12, and the sense of oppression in our home was unrelenting. I saw shadow figures almost daily. My parents were stressed because they couldn't force me to eat, and my sister was suffering with all of this also, along with her own sense of being neglected. All of the attention was on me, unfortunately. I felt increasingly detached and helpless. All that ultimately mattered to me was to lose weight and to be light as air. Such an ironic disease, considering that the only way for me to feel autonomy, feel a sense of agency, was to starve myself out of the discomfort of my body, which housed only anxiety and overwhelming sadness, to starve the point of possible annihilation. I felt that I was a small pinprick of light within myself, essentially barely there. My mother had been doing extensive research and had discovered the existence of the disease, anorexia nervosa, and thus began the series of meetings with psychologists, diagnostic testing, and therapies, along with different behavior modification techniques. None of which cured me of anorexia, but most likely did slow its progress. One afternoon, shortly after it was known that I weighed 52 pounds, I was informed that the psychologist I was seeing at the time recommended hospitalization. But later, my mother told me that she and my dad had decided against that. She told me that if I was going to die, then I was going to die at home. Sometime previous to this, but during the same year when I was 13, my dad had gone to a convention in California, where he met a couple of Reiki masters. It was at this time, I believe, that Reiki got its major start, organized start in the U.S. He invited one of them to come to our home, ostensibly to visit while she was at a conference in Oklahoma City, but also to see if she could help me. I remember feeling a strong wave-like energy swirling from her hands around my clasped hands during her healing session. But this healing did not help, at least not in any immediate sense. My dad then became acquainted with a well-known psychic and astrologist from Chicago. Her name was Irene Hughes. And he became acquainted with another well-known psychic from England, Rose Gladden, whom he must have met at a seminar or conference. Irene traveled across the United States for radio interviews, and Rose lectured at medical institutions in the UK, in Europe, and in the United States. Irene stayed with us for a few days when she had a radio interview in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And Rose stayed with us over generally the same few days while she was on tour in the U.S. I remember the first time I met Rose. I will never forget this. I was standing in the kitchen. I was 12 years old. My parents were also there, and she walked into the kitchen and smiled this lovely, radiant smile and introduced herself. She was a tall, imposing, yet gentle woman whose presence emitted a power, kindness, and compassion I had never encountered. I began to cry, and I couldn't stop. Rose and Irene did what they could to help. Rose said that I was born what she called an open sensitive, and said that there were two entities attached to me who were bound to the land and the house. One elderly lady and the other was a young girl. The girl was the older lady's granddaughter. And this young girl had died while riding her horse on the property. She had snapped her neck. They wanted me to be with them. They wanted me to stay with them. Rose informed us that the elderly lady had been involved during her life in negative esoteric practices. Rose was able to induce them, though, to leave and move on. Rose also informed us that there was an entity which was attached to the land, and he had been an Indian who had been buried on the land where there was a ritual mound in the dense woods at the back of our property. She said that she did not remove this entity as he did not want to leave and he was not negative and would not harm us. She then told us that there was an old, extremely negative entity, possibly demonic, which she could not remove, and she was uncertain as to whether it was bound to the house or the land. She also informed us that my illness was being exacerbated by the entities, but that we would eventually leave this house and that I would be all right in the long term. Irene had been saying, was the astrologist and psychic from Chicago, and she had been staying in the guest house, the little house. And she saw an entity, a man whom she described to us, and my sister spoke up and said that it was our paternal grandfather, who had been in our memory and was known to be a very gentle, kind person. He had actually passed away 2 or 3 years previously. My sister had seen him in our driveway, and she told Irene this. She had seen him in our driveway not long previously, between the house and the guest house, behind the house. And he had smiled at her, and he had his hat. He often wore a hat. Later, I learned from my father that my granddad, the paternal grandfather I was speaking of, he had read the works of Edgar Cayce and had been extremely interested in those works, and so had my dad. At the time I was about to turn 14, I had managed to keep my weight plateaued at 52 pounds. I was weak, I was mentally fatigued, and I continued to feel without hope. And although the heavy dread and oppression had lessened from the house after Rose had induced those two entities to move on, the feeling of near non-existence within my body persisted.
Introducing the High Strangeness Coffee Blend by Redacted Coffee Company, a medium roast of the Brazilian kind. This medium roast offers flavors of chocolate and vanilla combined with a distinct fruity taste and a unique sweet floral aroma. The experience of high strangeness doesn't end there, with a sweet butter aftertaste that doesn't fade as your coffee cools. This coffee regains its flavors all the way through your cup, ensuring it truly is good to the last drop. The veteran-funded, employee-owned Redacted Coffee Company and UFO Chronicles podcast have partnered together to bring you the best coffee on and off the planet. Get 20% off your first order now at redactedcoffee.com/UFO. That's redactedcoffee.com/UFO. Or follow the link below in this episode's description or click on the banner of my website. This podcast is fueled by coffee oozing high strangeness. So what are you waiting for? Wake up to the strange.
One late afternoon, I was upstairs in my bedroom, hanging up some clothes in my closet, when my mom came up the stairs and walked into my room. It was unusual because there was much distance between me and my mom at the time, and she rarely came upstairs. She asked me if I would try, just please give it a good try, to eat a little more and gain. Of course, my parents had asked me these same things countless times, but this time something was different. He spoke softly, without tension or frustration, with something different in addition. I looked at her and I told her I would. She said that dinner would be ready soon and she went downstairs. I came downstairs a few minutes later and my dad was sitting at the bottom of the stairs as he often did, waiting for my sister and I to come downstairs, usually in the evening, you know, before dinner time. I told him that mom had come upstairs and talked with me and that I would try to eat dinner. He was surprised, but also looked confused. He said that he had been sitting at the bottom of the stairs for the last 45 minutes or hour, and that mom had been in the kitchen the entire time and had not gone upstairs. So that was an interesting experience, and I don't know what happened there. It was not my mom, or perhaps it was a projection of my mom, or perhaps it was something else. But so began my years-long struggle to maintain a low but non-critical weight and to free myself of the anorexic illness. It wasn't until I was 21 years old that I was able to do so with the help of my therapist. Unfortunately, I continued to struggle with depression and to feel displaced within myself. When I was around 15 or 16 years old, my sister and I had gone to stay for a week with our paternal grandmother, and we stayed one night during that time with our aunt and cousin. This was again in Sulphur, Oklahoma, and they lived in the same town as our grandmother. That evening, everyone was asleep, and I was still awake. I was sitting in a recliner in their living room reading a book. Their dog was resting on the floor nearby. All was quiet, and suddenly their dog raised his head, looked directly at me and slightly behind me. He stood up, and he started growling. He stood there growling at me for what seemed like several minutes, and then he backed out of the room and went into another room. This was atypical behavior for their dog, who was friendly and sweet, and I was stunned and also riddled with fear, because I knew something negative was there with me. So I'm going to step aside from the chronological framework for a moment or two. There were a meaningful set of events set years apart, which later served to crack open the structure of my belief system, which had been built around me and my sister as children. First, my mother finally found a woman therapist when I was about 15, with whom I established a significant rapport and whose guidance helped me to survive the reverberations of the initial onslaught of anorexia and carried me through many years of turbulence following that initial onslaught, which included suicide attempts at the age of 18. Those years I spent struggling to maintain a non-critical weight, to live with my overly empathic self, and to come to terms with what appeared to me to be a ludicrous, greed and power-obsessed, violent society and world, and to do this eventually without the buffering denial of anorexia. I think that my therapist knew that we had merely plucked the superficial strands of a deep, multifaceted web of well-protected traumatic memories, and that we had progressed as far as we could at that time, with some important goals accomplished and set, including my completing college and moving on to graduate school. Second, a dyad of connected events 4 years apart. I have two presently healthy daughters, but in 2012, my younger daughter, who was 12 years old at that time, revealed to me her traumatic experience, which she had kept secret for 6 years. This nearly shattered me. I was in awe of her bravery in voicing this to me, but I also knew that she was suffering. So I immediately found a therapist for her who has been an invaluable guide for my daughter. She's doing fine now. Our father died in 2015. Then a couple of months later in 2015, my sister was diagnosed early with an aggressive form of breast cancer. I will come back to this later, and I hope it hasn't been confusing kind of jumping ahead of it. I had been working with my therapist for a couple of years when I had gone to California to Pepperdine University for my first year of college in 1984 and 1985. Academically, I did well, but I became homesick and moved to Oklahoma to that Hidden Valley house, and I resumed seeing my therapist. I fell into a deep depression, and after my suicide attempt, my therapist and I worked more intensely to find a path toward healing. She commented often that I had a very strong internal censor. We made extremely slow but gradual progress. She engaged me by appealing to academic and intellectual theories and discussions. She was working on her master's degree in social work, and we discussed family dynamics, symbiosis, abandonment theory, and we read and discussed a really important book which had recently come out at that time called The Golden Cage, The Enigma of Anorexia Nervosa by Hilda Roush. I had turned to discuss the anomalous experiences I'd had, but these held no validity for her, other than what she felt were psychological manifestations, magical thinking perpetuated by my parents. So I had essentially no one with whom to discuss these anomalous experiences, aside from my family, and the experiences were still raw and frightening to me as they were to my sister. So I never attempted to talk about it with anyone, and my sister didn't either. We actually didn't even talk with each other about these experiences once we entered our 20s. In 1986, my parents moved to Wichita, Kansas, and I decided to move with them. My sister remained in Edmond, Oklahoma, and proceeded to get her degree and master's degree there. I continued to drive to Oklahoma City once a month to see my therapist throughout 1987. In late 1986, I resumed college and went on to graduate and moved on toward a master's degree in comparative literature with a minor in women's studies. I had begun to listen to NPR, and there was a special program on NPR in the evening. This was in the late 80s, early 90s, called Night Crossing. It was a New Age music program which played from about 10 to 11 o'clock at night. So in the evenings as I went to sleep, I would listen to this. And I had also begun meditating regularly. One evening, as night crossings ended and I was drifting off to sleep, I had a lucid dream where I stood up from the bed and walked over to my closet door. I was slowly opening my closet door, and as I was opening the door, I heard a booming, deep voice in my ears yelling, "No," while simultaneously the door was pushed from my grasp and slammed shut. I jolted awake in my bed. I didn't realize until years later that I was able to lucid dream once again. I hadn't had any lucid dreams since my childhood, and I had had this dream as a result of meditation, and that something was apparently trying to protect me from opening, in quotes, opening the door to a conscious surfacing of traumatic memory. I'd like to go back briefly to when I was around 10 years old, beginning around 1976 or so. My father began searching for more spiritual avenues which were resonant for him, and he discovered Ekankar. It's a spiritual organization. This was also the time frame when he became a founding member of a holistic medicine society and began to utilize hypnosis in his medical practice. Later, when I was around 14, he had hypnotized me as a part of my science project at school, where he drove a long needle through the skin and tissue of my hand between my thumb and index finger, and where I was hypnotically directed that I would feel no pain and would not bleed. My parents took pictures and a video to document this, and I felt no pain and I did not bleed. My dad said that I easily achieved a deep somnambulist state of hypnosis. Then later, in 1981 or 82, when I was 15 or 16, and I was still struggling, he had tried to hypnotize me in an attempt to undergo hypnotic regression so that I could perhaps recall anything which might bring some awareness as to the root of the anorexia and thus the key for me to be free of it. However, during this hypnotic regression, I went completely blank, as though an impenetrable barrier had been placed. I could remember absolutely nothing. So I turned to Ekankar for help. My mom joined this group around 1970. At that time, they mailed reading material. And Dad gave the reading material oriented for children and then young teens to me, my sister. when I was around 15 or so, I expanded my own reading into spiritual subtopics. I recognized Eckhart as a melding of Eastern spirituality concepts and Western Christian religion, and I came to distrust it rather quickly. My father was a lifelong adherent of Eckhart, as was my mother, until a couple of years after my dad passed away. Anyway, after we moved to Kansas, my dad felt that finally, with the assistance of Eckhart masters, he was able to combat and lock out the demonic entity, which he felt still had its hold on me and continued to threaten our family. So during the years of 1986 to 2007, I experienced a general hiatus from anomalous events, and I immersed myself in college and graduate school in 1993 when I was 27, with two daughters, and my sister also married and had a son and a daughter. We all had many good years during this time, creating many wonderful memories. I continued to read literature, philosophy, and books on art and spirituality, and I continued at times sporadically to meditate. I resonated most with Buddhist thought, and I practiced Zen meditation. But after our first daughter was born, I became too busy to join a Sangha group. Our first daughter was born in 97, and by the age of 9 months, it became apparent that she wasn't meeting developmental milestones. And a pediatric developmentalist diagnosed her with cerebral palsy based on an MRI and testing due to a stroke in utero. My husband and I went through the stages of grief, but then got to work taking her to occupational and physical therapy. As the next few years went by, we began to see behavior problems with her, including severe temper tantrums, night trouble with sleeping, and body movement repetitions, rocking and the flapping of hands. It's called perseveration and stimming. And we took her to several psychologists who had only diagnosed her with pervasive developmental disorder at that time. And it was an extremely broad diagnosis due to her age. The stress of these years began to slowly chip away at our marriage. Our second daughter was born in 2000. She was an easy baby, but she did begin to have night terrors, beginning at the age of one and continuing to around three. I remember her later telling me that during these night terrors, she often saw a strange, empty landscape with a giant egg-shaped object sitting not far from her, and she was paralyzed with terror. Around 2002, when our first daughter was five and our second daughter was two, our oldest daughter's behavior worsened. She had been in special needs preschool. We were taking her to a psychologist, and we were doing our best to parent her with love and patience. But my parenting strategies and my husband's parenting strategies were not compatible, and our marriage began to deteriorate. I loved my daughter deeply, and I believe that her dad did also, but we were overwhelmed yet determined to find ways to reach her. In 2005, our marriage failed, and the girls and I moved in with my parents for 1.5 years until I bought my own house. Their dad and I arranged for shared custody, alternating weekends. In 2007, when my older daughter was 10, she was diagnosed with autism by functioning. The following years involved more therapy, along with several surgeries to lengthen her left heel cord as she grew. And my younger daughter, when she was five, began to describe to me and painted several pictures of a young boy who she saw in some of her lucid dreams and who told her he was her guide. Through my readings, I knew about guides, and I knew that my younger daughter was a sensitive. I encouraged her always and emphasized to both my daughters that they visualize a protective light around themselves every night. I was mindful of the importance to practice balance between talking of anomalous and spiritual experiences with them, particularly with my younger daughter, and tending to everyday physical reality and activities. In 2007, I moved into my own house, a 3-bedroom, 1-bath little bungalow. My daughters and I established a cozy home, adding to our family two sweet cats, Coco and Misha. My older daughter had incredible, amazing special needs teachers throughout grade school, middle school, and high school. And in the long term, she did very well, and she's still doing very well. However, there were many, many rough and stressful years along the way. My younger daughter was artistic, funny, kind, and quite headstrong, but she and my older daughter never got along well, which also led to many stressful, many difficult moments and situations. In 2008 or so, my younger daughter was diagnosed with simple partial seizures, and she took an anti-seizure medication for a few years, after which she no longer needed it. In fifth grade, she began playing the violin, and over the years, she became extremely proficient and continued to play through high school. In 2009, I was 43. My older daughter was 12, and my younger daughter was 9. My depression returned. I was exhausted by years of stress and worry, even though I attempted to meditate regularly and maintain a positive outlook for my daughters. After many years of quietude pertaining to my anomalous experiences, I had a life-altering experience in September 2009, and I recorded this. So this was in 2009. I was 43. My life over the past decade, plus a few years, had some very difficult transitions, which I've mentioned. And at this time, in 2009, I distinctly and repetitively had an urgent impression and feeling that I needed to ask for help on a spiritual level. I knew I was in the midst of struggling with depression once again, and I felt physically, mentally, emotionally drained and exhausted. I believe that it was shortly after my 43rd birthday that this event occurred. I had been sleeping comfortably. My bedroom was upstairs. My daughter's bedrooms were downstairs. And upstairs, it was just my bedroom, nothing else. Every night, my cat, Misha, would sleep with me on the bed. So I had been sleeping, and I felt myself begin to arise to consciousness toward wakefulness, what I later learned to be the hypnopompic state, when my eyes suddenly opened. Simultaneously, now I say my eyes opened, but I knew that somehow my physical eyes were closed, and yet my eyes opened and I could see what looked to be my ceiling, but I couldn't see anything else. Simultaneously, I heard a soft popping noise in my ears, and my hearing abruptly changed, becoming extremely acute, as though my hearing had been magnified and altered. I then distinctly heard footsteps stepping up the wooden stairs leading from our downstairs living room hallway up to my bedroom. And with each footstep, I could hear the sweeping sound of a long robe. I immediately frightened. The hair stood up on my arms and back of my neck and my head, the top of my head. My heart rate increased. My breathing became quick and shallow. And I tried to move, but my limbs, my head, my entire body paralyzed. Strangely, although my eyes were open, I knew that my physical eyes were closed and I could see nothing but the plain off-white surface of a ceiling, and I was unable to move my gaze. It was as though I could only see this off-white ceiling, even though I sensed the presence of someone in the room with me and could subsequently see shifts in degrees of light. Misha, my cat, was lying partially on the bed and partially across my left rib cage, with his head and front legs resting on me, and he was purring happily, contentedly, and quite loudly, and he continued to purr throughout this entire experience. Because Misha was purring and was obviously not disturbed, I decided to attempt to calm down, take deep breaths, and relax into this experience. So I heard the footsteps reach the top of the stairs and walk to the foot of my bed. The fabric of what I intuited to be a long robe swooshing with each step. There was absolutely no doubt in my mind that this was not a dream. I was in a state of heightened awareness, and all that was transpiring was real, even more real somehow than normal reality, the normal waking state. I felt a sensation of warmth descend upon my feet lightly. I had been lying on my back while sleeping and remained in this position. The presence, and I knew this presence being, which was obviously walking on two legs, but I could neither see this being nor receive an impression as to whether it was male or female. And this being never communicated anything to me. It walked from the foot of my bed to my left side and stopped midway between the foot and head of my bed. Misha was still lying on my left side and purring loudly. I felt a sensation like that of a light, gentle massaging with what I assumed were hands. And this massaging was accompanied by focused warmth. The massaging and warmth began at the top of my left leg and continued down to my left foot. It then moved to the top of my right leg and continued down to my right foot. In utter astonishment, I fully realized that this massaging was not directly on my physical skin, And yet I felt it intensely in the space just above my skin, which yet still seemed to be a part of my being. And I'm assuming it was my etheric body or my subtle body, an extension of my physical self, like a type of radiation from my physical body, but also connected to it because I could feel it moving down my legs, but without touching my physical skin. It's difficult to describe, but it was intense, yet gentle, very warm, soothing, warm. And it was as real as someone touching my physical body, yet altered, altogether heightened in sensation. The massaging then moved and began at my left upper rib cage and proceeded down just to below my belly button. It then began on my right side at my rib cage, proceeding to just below my belly button. Misha, my cat, was still purring loudly. At this point, I was utterly fascinated and amazed. I was remaining calm, and I was just amazed. Suddenly, the light, which I can see above my face, greatly intensified and brightened, as though a light being focused over my face and neck. Could not see the source of this light. My sinuses popped loudly, both of them. I could feel and hear multiple pops from my sinuses as this light intensified over my face, and my hearing remained acute, heightened. The light and warmth of this energy emanating from this being's hands then moved to the top of my head, and I knew that the being was now positioned directly behind my head. Even though physically, the head of my bed was up against the wall, I knew this being was standing behind my head. I then felt hands gently wrap themselves around the back of my head, cradling my head at the occipital area, and I could feel a pull at the base of my skull, hands pulling upward. I felt my head began to lift, moving upward from my physical head and also slightly above the head of my bed. So upward and also moving at an upward angle above my physical head. And I could feel my shoulders moving backward and upward also, lifting, rising from my physical body. And I thought with complete excitement that I knew I was moving out of my body and I was consciously aware of it. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to be fine. This is going to be fine. This is amazing. I'm so excited. Misha was still purring. And then my alarm went off, and I jolted back into my body and jerked into wakefulness, physical wakefulness, into the familiar heaviness of my physical body. Misha jumped off the bed and ran downstairs. I was devastated that I hadn't been able to continue with the out-of-body experience, yet I was also filled with gratitude and wonder. My body, my entire being felt peaceful, and also it actually tingled with a physical and auditory vibrational hum for several treasured minutes. This had been the most amazing experience of my life, and I'll never forget it. It thoroughly validated my belief in the soul or in a form of consciousness which survives the body. Since this experience, I can say I have no fear of death. I don't know who or what that being was, but I choose to believe that it may have been my guide, or if not, then a beneficent being who responded to my humble request for help. I wish that that experience could have continued for sure. I wish that the being had communicated with me in some way, but I am thankful, deeply thankful for that gift and whatever healing was imparted. So that was that experience. And I have to say that since then, I had like a reverberation experiences that I feel that this experience allowed me to have, if that makes sense, almost like a ripple in a pond. So in retrospect, I know that this out-of-body experience functioned not only to help me at the time, but also to bolster me for the upcoming difficulties of the years ahead. So immediately following this experience, several anomalous events occurred. For about a month afterward, again, this was in 2009, I was about 43. Every morning as I awoke early before the girls woke up, I heard distinct voices talking downstairs, male and female, coming from the kitchen, more than two people, actually. I initially thought that the radio I had in the kitchen had somehow turned on by itself. I always listened to NPR and International Public Radio commentary every morning as I made breakfast, so I thought maybe the radio I heard the voices every morning as I came down the stairs, but as I walked into the kitchen, the voice faded and stopped, and the radio was gone.
Are you intrigued by Paranormal Talk Radio? You'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
Also, over the next 6 or 7 months into 2010, I experienced many hypnopompic and hypnagogic OBEs, out-of-body experiences. The majority of these were hypnagogic as I went to sleep after I meditated and began to fall asleep. I remember being utterly amazed again the first time this happened. As I fell asleep, I felt tingling vibrations in my hands and feet. My hearing changed acutely again because quite close and clear, but in an interior sort of similar to how one hears with headphones on, with no incoming sound or when underwater, very clear. I then felt my subtle body being pulled. No one was pulling it. It was happening without my conscious volition. Out of my physical body to the side of the bed, and then I floated down to the floor, and I could actually feel the movement and sinking feeling to the floor. I then rose up to the ceiling of a bedroom and kind of bobbed up there. And I slowly moved toward my window, again feeling like a pulling sensation. I felt could have forced myself back into my body and consciousness if I wanted to, but I allowed myself to go with the experience. I went through the window of my upstairs bedroom and immediately I was in an ocean, floating horizontally in the water, deep below the surface, but I could see the surface high above and the water lit by a beautiful pale green and blue light. I began to slowly sink and I was not afraid. I saw multitudes of vibrantly colored fish, small to large fish, many different types, and many of them seemed to take a curious note of me. So some of them seemed to be actually sentient. I have never seen such vivid, vibrant colors. Unfortunately, as I was thinking, I couldn't maintain this state and I fell into sleep. On another occasion, I felt the same tingling and auditory sensations as I was falling asleep and my subtle body was pulled downward to the end of my bed, down to the floor, then up again to the ceiling and through my window. And this time, as I went through the window, I was flying through space at an incomprehensible rate of speed, approaching and passing gorgeously colored, brilliant, luminescent stars, collections of stars, with many ranges of colors, brilliant blues, reds, purples, lavenders. And many of them seemed to be sentient again, and just like the fish and aware of my passing presence. I then found myself walking down a dirt road. There were surrounding trees with a blue sky, and it looked like earth, but I knew that it wasn't earth. I walked into a type of community, simple houses. I walked through the front door of a house which felt oddly familiar to me. The rooms of the house were austere and simple, purposefully so. A man who appeared to be in his 30s or 40s was working in a room off the kitchen or living room, a type of work room. And he was doing some type of woodwork and metallurgy, but he had no need for special instruments, gloves, or protective gear. He recognized me, and I felt that he was glad to see me, but he was very serious and somber. And I began to work beside him, and I was perfectly content. I felt a comfortable sense of joy. Then I fell into sleep. I had many OBEs where the same process would occur as I fell to sleep. I would pass through my window and would then find myself flying through deep space. I never knew precisely where I was going. It was though I was being guided, but by whom I have no idea. My guide, my higher self, and interdimensional higher intelligence, I don't know. During one of these OBEs, I was flying through deep space and saw a cluster of what I thought were stars, multicolored. But as I neared it, flying near it and kind of curving around it, it was still far away, but I could see it clearly. The lights turned to ruby red, and they were dispersed in the shape of a tree. And the ruby red light from the stars were, the light was luminescent, glowing. It was indescribably beautiful. Again, later I lost that experience. I fell into sleep. On another occasion, as I fell to sleep, I decided to attempt to direct the OBE, to try to be conscious of what I was doing and direct myself downstairs to check on my daughters. As I sank to the floor and began to rise again, I turned toward the top of the stairs. It was then that I noticed my vision was blurry, and I distinctly felt a material, what I could only describe as a type of cowl, wrapped around my head and impeding my vision, and I heard it rustle against my ears. I still managed to locate the top of the stairs, and I began to descend in a floating manner, but as I reached the bottom, I fell into sleep. What puzzled me then and does now most about my OBEs was the fact that I could not maintain the experience, that with each experience, I fell into sleep before I returned to my body. After a few months, I had several separate anomalous experiences where in the hypnagogic state and hypnopompic state with the concomitant acute hearing paralysis, I felt and heard someone lie down on my bed beside me. I could feel the presence next to me, could hear the comforter and sheets being compressed. Each time, it was so frightening to me that I was able to jolt myself free from the paralysis state. On one of those occasions, I was lying on my side. The being or entity lay down behind me and put an arm around me. I couldn't move to see the arm or the presence behind me, but as before, I was terrified. I jolted myself awake, and it was early morning, around dawn. About 4 months after that initial experience, I again went out of my body while falling asleep, hypnagogic, floated out of my window in an upright position, and found myself in the ocean. I turned and was floating in a horizontal position then, facing the surface. Unlike the previous ocean experience, however, the water was dark, dense, and a dirty green color. There were fish, but they were drab shades of dark gray and army green, and they took no notice of me. I began to sink, but this time I felt afraid. As I was sinking, I turned my body slightly and turned my head to look below me, and I saw a thick swarming of tentacles like those of a giant octopus rising up from the depth toward my feet. I was now sinking with my feet toward the bottom in an upright position, but I was looking down at my feet. I realized with horror that the tentacles were purposely going for my feet, and I released a scream and forced myself out of the OBE state. After these utterly terrifying anomalous experiences, their frequency decreased and then ceased, beginning in late 2010, 2011. Although my lucid dreams continued unabated, I began to suspect that possibly all of us have OBEs, but we're not conscious during them most of the time. Most of us never. I feel that I was consciously experiencing these OBEs, that consciousness was at a level where I could experience and remember these OBEs, and that it was the direct result of a healing experience during my extended sleep paralysis event. I also feel that there are gradations of states of awakened consciousness achieved through meditation and during sleep states, ranging from lucid dreams to OBEs, and that we can transfer from a lucid dream into an OBE and vice versa. I have some interesting dreams, but I'm going to skip those because I have a few more events to share. Beginning in 2012, a series of extremely difficult events in my family ensued, which nearly ripped our family apart, the specific details of which I can't really talk about. But in 2012, my younger daughter revealed to me something which happened to her within our family 6 years previously, which she had not remembered until she was 12. The repercussions of this were traumatic, but I fully believed and supported her. And over the years and with therapy, she has healed and is currently doing very well. In June 2015, my father passed away from complications with Parkinson's disease. In August 2015, my sister was diagnosed with breast cancer and underwent surgery and began chemotherapy. In 2017, my sister experienced a near catastrophic deluge of surfacing previously suppressed traumatic memories. As my daughter, my sister, and I opened up to each other over the years following 2017, this is my younger daughter, we realized that each of our minds had suppressed traumas which were intergenerational, belying our family's outward presentation. Each of us were fortunate to be able to establish a long-standing rapport and engagement with female therapists so that we were able to process these memories and their reverberations and manifestations in our lives. The manifestation of my suppressed trauma had been anorexia. The manifestation of my sister's suppressed trauma had been cancer. And the manifestation of my daughter's suppressed trauma had been cutting. We each also have experienced previously, contemporaneously, and beyond the physical manifestations of the trauma, annulled us through our lives. And the only reason I mention these physical traumas we had is because I feel that they are intertwined with our anomalous experiences. So from 2012 to 2017, my anomalous experiences ceased for a while, but I continued to meditate and I continued to read voraciously, mainly Thich Nhat Hanh and Pema Chodron for emotional and spiritual support. After 2017, my sister and I became extremely close. We always had a good relationship, but after that time, our relationship became unbreakably close. And we discussed our past in detail, including intergenerational trauma and the process of dissolving intergenerational karma. I also discussed with her my concept of parallel trauma, physical trauma in this present life, and also trauma-related intergenerational karma through reincarnation, and anomalous trauma through paranormal experiences in this life, also possibly tied to intergenerational karma. In the spring or summer of 2017, I was living in an apartment at that time with my older daughter, and my younger daughter had begun college, and she was living with her boyfriend. And in this apartment, there's a living room and dining room, and off the dining room is a small balcony. And the entirety of the balcony could be seen from the living room or the dining room. It was all glass. So I was walking, I think it was on the weekend, because I think it was like early afternoon. I was walking in the living room / dining room area, and I saw on the rail of the balcony, of course, this is second story, it was a praying mantis, and it was a large one. It was about 3.5 to 4 inches tall. And I saw it from inside, and it was just standing on the balcony railing. So I went out to the railing, and I picked it up, and I took it inside, and I went and got my camera, and I took a picture of it because I wanted to send it to my younger daughter. I had never actually seen a praying mantis, you know, aside from pictures or videos or a program, TV program. So I was holding this praying mantis, and I kid you not, it was staring at me, and it would not stop staring at me. It just sat there on my hand, and I looked at it and kind of talked to it for, I don't know, maybe a good 5 minutes. It was a light green color, and I then walked back out on the balcony, and I put it back on the railing, and I wished it well and to have a good day, and closed my door and went about my day. But what's interesting is, within that week after I saw that mantis, I awoke early one morning. It was probably, I don't know what time it was. It was probably around 4 o'clock, because when I did fully awake, you know, it had that early morning light. But I awoke due to those out-of-body experience sensations again. I had the acute hearing. I had the tingling in my hands and feet and the back of my neck. But I also heard this really loud humming noise. And I had these extremely strong vibrations running from the tailbone of my spine. And I could feel it run all the way up my spine to the top of my cervical spine, the top of my neck, to the base of my skull, and then back down to my tailbone, the whole time vibrating strongly. And the whole time there was this loud humming noise. It vibrated like this and made a circuit of my spine probably 5 or 6 times. The vibrations were so strong that I was shaking. I felt like my body was shaking with the force of it. It did not hurt. It was not painful. And then it ceased, and I awoke fully. And that was the only time I had an experience like that. I have not had another experience like that. But again, I was just amazed. In 2018, I had gone camping in Colorado out near Salida with my younger daughter. We were in separate tents, but for a while we were in the same tent. We fell asleep in the same tent night. in my tent. And we were going to sleep. We weren't near any other people. We were kind of out in an area where there weren't any nearly placed tents. And this was a quick experience, but it has stuck in my memory. I was, again, on my way to sleep, and it almost sounded like a helicopter. It sounded like a deep whooshing sound, vibrating again, but it was just a powerful sound in my ears that seemed to come from some distance and came whooshing through the tent and into my tent and then out. It happened very fast, but it was so loud, and the vibration of it, the force of it was so strong that it woke me up completely. And I asked my daughter, "Did you hear that?" And she had been asleep, but she woke up and she said, "No, I didn't hear anything." So that was a curious incident. In 2018 and 2019, things were quiet regarding my anomalous experiences, aside from my continued lucid dreaming. I have always continued with my meditation practice. In 2019, I moved back to Oklahoma City. I brought my older daughter with me. I came back to Oklahoma City for a better job opportunity, and I'm near my sister and mom who live here. My older daughter, again, is with me, living with me, and my younger daughter is in a nursing program about to finish. And my lucid dreams have continued, and I'd like to share one of those that occurred in February 2019. I was standing inside of a house. It seemed to be made of white marble. I was at the door frame, which looked out onto a white porch with white columns. They looked Grecian, which in turn looked out onto a blue sky. It seemed that I was elevated somewhere, that this structure was elevated quite high somewhere. I don't know where it was. My father was standing by one of the columns, leaning against it, and he was dressed in a light-colored suit. It was a white-colored suit. He just looked at me and made no move to come closer to me. I looked at him and said nothing, and I made no move to cross through the doorway threshold. And he asked me distinctly, "Are you going to give up?" I paused in my dream and I thought, and I said, "No, I am not going to give up." He said nothing else to me, and I said nothing else to him. Then an amazingly beautiful, tall, white horse walked up to me and looked at me, and I started petting it and talking to it. And I was telling the horse that I missed her, and did she remember me? And that's all I remember of that lucid dream. I fell into a regular dream state. And I relate that dream because it connects, there's something interesting about it with a later experience. So June of 2021, I'm in Oklahoma now, and I was sitting on my second floor balcony in Oklahoma before getting ready for bed. And I still do this every night. I read and I go outside, and I like to sit outside and just do a light meditation or just relax and sit outside. Usually between 9 and 10 o'clock, somewhere around there. And I sit outside for about 20 minutes and look at the sky and just relax. And so I had gone outside onto my balcony, and I was just sitting there quietly observing the sky and the trees and enjoying quiet. I knew I had to get up extra early the next morning to take my daughter to a surgery center for a minor surgery. And I had to have her there at 5:30. So I went out on my balcony a little bit earlier, around 8:45 or so. The sky was partly cloudy, but I could still see the clear sky also. It had rained quite a bit over the last several days and nights. As I was restfully gazing at the sky, I saw what I thought was a shooting star, and it had a train. So it looked like a shooting star or a shooting meteor, and it had a very clear train to it that, you know, it shot down on my right up fairly high off in the distance, and it took like a second for that shooting star to shoot and the train to disappear. And I just thought, oh wow, a beautiful shooting star. Right after it disappeared, it was close to where the shooting star disappeared, maybe slightly high, but about the same distance as where the shooting star disappeared. A small, round, bright, white light flashed. And it was a flash. Quick flash. Seconds later, an identical small white light flashed, but it flashed to the far left of my vision, still above my eye level, but somewhat closer in the sky. Immediately after this light flashed, another small white light flashed slightly to the right of my vision, directly within the upper branches of the slender tree, which stands about 4 yards from my balcony. So within seconds, that light, and it was the same light, these weren't different lights, that same light flashed again in the distant sky, slightly to my left above eye level. And within a second again, the light flashed directly in front of me, only a few feet from the edge of my balcony, between the balcony railing and my tree. The light then flashed once more, and this time it was in the distant sky, to the far left and slightly above my eye gaze level. And then it flashed once more and shot again incredibly swiftly upward and to the left with another train of light as it disappeared. This just completely, I just sat there in wonder. I could not believe what I just saw, but I clearly saw it. I was completely awake. I had not been falling asleep. And this light was clear and bright, and it went from far out in the sky. I'm not good with the distances and things like that, but it was way far out, the shooting star. And then within a few flashes, it was right up close within my tree and then back out again, all within a matter of, I would say, not even 3 minutes. So that was that experience in June of 21. In January or February of this year, I had a lucid dream that I would like to relate. I dreamed that I was in the kitchen area of the Hidden Valley house, the house that was haunted. And I was in the kitchen. The kitchen had a blue carpet flooring to it, and it was a rather large kitchen. I was standing in the kitchen. There was no one else in the room from me aside from, and let me preface this by saying this was part of a longer dream, but I don't remember the first part of the dream. So I have this specific part of this dream that I remember very clearly. And it was a lucid dream. It was very, very clear and real. So I was in the kitchen, and on the blue carpet was a white miniature pony, but it had disproportionately long front and back legs. And it was initially lying down in the kitchen. It was lying on the kitchen carpet with its back to me. And then it turned and saw me, and it stood up and walked toward me. And I noticed it had a long, disproportionately long neck. And it had a disproportionately long face. And again, it's all white. It walks up to me so that its face is very close to mine, to my face, as though, and I got the feeling it was trying to communicate something, but nothing came across. Its eyes were crystal and blue and shaped like almonds. So it wasn't really a horse's eyes. It was not shaped like a horse's eyes. And I guess horse's eyes are a little bit almond shaped, but these eyes were huge. They were very big and almond shaped. The eyes were situated near the sides of the horse's head, and it had a very long face. And it was trying to tell me something. It seemed somewhat sad, like it knew something about me, and it was saddened. So maybe because that dream was situated in that haunted house where we had gone through so much difficulty and trauma, maybe that's why it seemed so sad. But again, I don't remember anything else with this lucid dream. I fell back into a deeper sleep. But I mentioned this because I believe a couple of your guests had mentioned the horse face, the white horse. And this experience was something similar. And again, I don't know what it was, but I had that similar experience. Nick, I could go on. I have many more lucid dreams, but I know that it's getting long. And I believe I've expressed and shared some of the most important ones to me, which affected my life in a positive way, ultimately. And I want to thank you so much for allowing me to share these experiences.
Wonderful. You're more than welcome. Beth, you know, everything seems intertwined.
Yes, definitely so. And it's been arduous at times trying to figure things out, because I know there are things that I cannot remember, both on a physical, historical level and also on the spiritual or, you know, paranormal level. I think that there are things that happened that I don't remember. But it's been a very interesting journey, and I would not take back, delete any of my experiences.
Of course, of course. You know, when you lived in the Valley House, and you were saying about the previous owner's teenage boy, how his room was all painted black.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you wonder that the oppression feeling that was in the atmosphere that was in the house probably caused that teenage boy to then become depressed, I'd guess, somewhat.
I really believe so. Actually, I recall now that Rose Gladden, psychic from England, he also mentioned that particular room was where the presence of the entities of the old lady and her granddaughter were most strong. And that's also the room where my sister and I were terrified by those ticking noises at night. So I do believe that most likely the teenage boy who had lived in that room and painted it black had been affected in negative ways. I don't know anything about that previous family who left or why they left. I think my parents tried to find out about that, but they were unable to.
Yeah, because you said that they were practicing some negative occult.
Yes, Rose said that the grandmother to the girl, she said that she was into some type of negative occult practices, and that she and the daughter were exacerbating my physical illness at the time, the anorexia, because they wanted me to stay with them. And that was quite terrifying.
Negative occult practices. It makes you wonder that when people are dealing with issues, whether it's anorexia, depression, how much of this is, you know, like you said, exacerbated from an outside force.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do believe that happens. I fully believe that happens. And whether one inadvertently opens oneself up to these things by, you know, playing with a Ouija board or practicing some occult practices, which are, you know, more on the negative side or can be, without knowing, you know, a board I would never use. But, you know, people can use tarot cards, for example. And as long as they're grounded and they have researched what they're doing and they are spiritually grounded themselves and know how to protect themselves, then I think that that's okay. But I think if someone's inadvertently doing this or doing these things on purpose without the correct preparation and protection, then yes, you can definitely open yourself up to some negative entities that are out there. And I think they're out there all the time. I never did anything like that, even inadvertently, but Rose said I had been born an open, sensitive, and that this is why they were attracted to me. I think also because I was born an open sensitive, I believe, it's just my opinion, that predisposed me to some depression and perhaps even that illness at all.
Of course, you're like a beacon, you know, you're going to attract those kinds of energies.
Exactly. And I didn't know how to protect myself. I do now, but at the time I did not know how.
Having lived and survived with anorexia nervosa and depression, of course, you know, there's people out there which suffer, and you know, maybe some of our listeners, what advice would you have for someone that's struggling with those types of diseases?
Sure. Yes, and I can honestly say that I've struggled on and off with depression all of my life since I was 11. And with anorexia, that's very difficult. The disease warps your thinking so severely, such a strange mental type of illness. But I believe that I would not have been able to rid myself of that illness had I not had years of therapy. That was integral, I believe, to me being able to move past, completely past that illness. And like I mentioned, an illness like that, even though you work on moving past it, it takes time because it's so severe. It takes time because there are reverberations from it. It's almost like it wipes out years of your life, and you have to go back and rebuild that. That's the best way I can describe it. But I think for anyone struggling with anorexia, it is critical that you get professional help, that you get therapy specifically. That's the only thing that helped me. And I did have a supportive family at the time. You know, thank God for my mother and the research she did and her persistence. I mean, her dogged persistence in taking me from one psychologist to another, to a psychiatrist, to another psychologist, to all these testings, and she would not give up. And that's another quick thing is if you see a therapist and you don't establish rapport with that therapist and it's not clicking, leave, go in a therapist until you find one with whom you can establish rapport, because there are so many out there, and you know they're all, I'm sure, very good, but you know it just comes down to which one you find your rapport with specifically. With depression, and honestly, you know, when my depression came on, my childhood depression at 11, there really wasn't anything as far as medication to take. Maybe amitriptyline, you know, that old medication. But of course, children did not take that. So there really wasn't anything medication-wise to help me then. And again, therapy helped me quite a bit. But, you know, my depression was such that, you know, some life events would trigger it and it would just come at me like a beast and just take me down. But I kept on seeing my therapist, and she really guided me through all that. And I would say also that when I started meditating in my 20s, that greatly significantly helped me cope with my depression. So I had my therapist, I had meditation. Something I didn't mention too, when my second daughter was born and my older daughter's behaviors continued to worsen, my depression hit pretty strong then again, and I recognized it as postpartum depression. And I called my dad at the time and I said, you know, I woke up and everyone would be better off without me. And he said, okay, I'm calling in a prescription for Prozac. I want you to go get up and start taking it today. And I did. And it really, really helped me. It took about 2 or 3 weeks to kick in, but it was night and day. And I took Prozac for about 3 or 4 years when it really stopped helping me. And sometimes those SSRIs do that. They poop out after a while. And I decided not to continue taking it. So I tapered off a bit, and I've done fine since then. But I do meditate regularly. I don't see a therapist. I think I stopped seeing my therapist, I believe I was around 23, 22 or 23. But I had seen her for 6 years pretty much. So I had a good selection of practices under my belt, so to speak, that I could use to help deal with the depression and function and get through it and come out of it.
Wonderful advice. Of course, it's a difficult thing to struggle with. Some people think they can deal with these issues on their own without any help, but we all need help sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to, as soon as you recognize, you know, what possibly you could have, seek the help, the support groups, there's therapy out there, you know, don't be on your own.
Undoubtedly. Yes. Big yes to that. Please seek out help. There are so many people, so many wonderful, good therapists and support groups. And, you know, with people struggling with depression or with mostly women, a small percentage of men do have anorexia nervosa. Mostly it's women. And, you know, treatment with this illness has progressed so far since the 80s. It's progressed so far, and there's so much out there for where people can reach out to. So it's readily available for sure.
That's great. You know, even if that just reaches just one person, you know, that's good.
Exactly.
We have to, you know, because everyone has, you know, everyone has lived most of us have lived a long life, you know, and we have all gone through problems, whether it's mental health or drugs or, you know, just about everyone. So, mm-hmm. you know, and everyone mm-hmm. needs help now and again. So if it just, you know, if someone just reaches yeah. one listener, then that's, you know, I'm happy about that.
And that's why this was hard for me because I know many of your other experiencers who have bravely come on to share their experiences have mentioned this, but I haven't talked to anyone about these, particularly these anomalous experiences. And I have talked to very few people about my anorexia. So I really wanted to share because I thought, just like I feel that I have greatly benefited from many, many of the people who have shared on your podcast. And just like you said, I was hoping that, you know, whether it's depression or anorexia or, you know, the anomalous experiences, if it strikes a chord, if it helps even one person, then I feel like it's a great gift for me. And I'm so thankful. And I'm thankful to have lived so far to be 55 years old.
It's a good age, mind. I'm not there yet. I'm not quite there yet, but not too far off.
It is good, isn't it? It really is. It's there's so much to look forward to. I thought, you know, when I was in my 30s, I thought, oh my gosh, 50s, that sounds so old. But I don't feel old. I don't feel old at all.
Yeah, it's when you reach a point where the adults used to look up to, the film stars and musicians, you know, when you've gone past their ages, you know, that's when it kind of hit me. All my idols, and you know, from the movies and.
Exactly. Oh, and yes. And, you know, did you hear yesterday that Olivia Newton-John passed away?
That's right. She did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very sad. It was cancer, really, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was cancer. Her cancer returned. I don't know in what form, but yeah, she passed away from complications from her cancer returning. But she was a bright light, for sure. A bright light.
Yeah. She was loved by many.
Yes. And helped many.
Agreed. Yeah. Agreed.
And, you know, the state of the world right now is not great at all. So I am particularly mindful to meditate and to read spiritual books, and to keep myself balanced. And I think we all need to do that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, my wife will be watching the news and she'd tell me, oh, this has happened, or, I'm not even talking about world news. I'm just talking about normal events. And I'll say, turn it off. Relax.
Yes.
You know, don't let these things get to you. You know, you really have to just keep on moving forward.
Exactly.
Be aware of this kind of stuff, but, you know, kind of have the horse blinkers on and don't let it bring you down.
That's exactly right. And that's what I had to do. I had to do that. You know, I would listen to National Public Radio or Public Radio International and watch a little bit of the news on the television almost every day. But I tell you, last year, I stopped watching the news on the television, and I might listen to the radio once or twice a week, and that's it. It's too much. It's just too much negativity.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't really watch TV anymore. I do keep up with current events and stuff. But yeah, we got rid of, because in the UK we have like what's called a TV license. So you got to pay a certain amount a year hold this license, right? It's not worth anything, to be honest with you. We stopped ours about 16 years ago. The news is biased, especially the UK news, biased over here. And
it is here too. Yeah.
Really bad over there.
That's an understatement, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not particularly inclined one way or another, but it is a really big problem over there. But this is from an outsider.
Yeah. Mind.
Beth, I really appreciate you for coming on today and sharing all that for our listeners.
Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you for having me on. It's been a great gift, and it's just been wonderful. Thank you so much. And I wish you the best, and that your podcast continues to help people for many years.
Thank you. That's great. And it was lovely talking to you. Okay. And take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Oh, it was lovely talking to you as well. Thank you, Nick. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye for now. That is all for this episode. Keep updated and connected with the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And if you have an encounter that you'd like to share on the podcast, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com, or you can reach out to me via the contact page on my website, ufochroniclespodcast.com. A big thank you to Beth for sharing tonight, and thank you all for listening. I will be back next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.